Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 2nd, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is set on the front steps of the United States Capitol building. In the very foreground is Nancy Pelosi. She's pointing, and in her left hand she has a shepherd's crook. Around her feet and all up and down the stairs are cats of all different colors, dozens and dozens of cats. The headline is Powerful Legacy: How Pelosi's Two Decades of Hurting Democrats Changed the Country. And we'll read that on the Talking Points page, but we'll start today with two short main stories and how they were covered. Massacre at a gay club in Colorado Springs. What happened? Activists and progressives warned of a growing climate of hatred against the LGBTQ community after a gunman went on a killing spree at a gay nightclub in conservative Colorado Springs. The shooter, Anderson Lee Aldrich, 22, immediately opened fire with an AR-15, killing five people and injuring at least 25 in less than a minute, before being tackled by a patron who is being hailed as a hero. Richard Fierro, an Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran who was at the club with his wife and daughter, jumped on the 300-pound gunman from behind and pinned him to the ground, beating the shooter in the head with his own pistol and calling on a passing drag performer to stomp him with a high heel. "I had to do something," said Fierro, whose daughter's boyfriend was among the casualties. "He was not going to kill my family." Club Q was hosting a drag show during the attack and had an all-ages drag brunch scheduled for the next day. Such shows have been criticized by conservative media and lawmakers, including Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican from Colorado, who say the performances are intended to groom children. After Boebert condemned the lawless violence without mentioning that the victims were LGBTQ, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, singled her out, saying, "You have played a major role in elevating anti-LGBT plus hate rhetoric and anti-trans lies while spending your time in Congress blocking even the most common sense gun safety laws." The shooter, who bought his guns legally, faces charges of murder and hate crimes. What the columnist said: "This attack was at once shocking and entirely predictable," said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. "Drag shows have become the prime target of the right's hateful rhetoric, with conservative politicians and talking heads screaming that drag events are part of a monstrous plot to prey on children. They can't deny responsibility when a sick man with a gun takes them seriously." Ever since the massacre at the gay nightclub Pulse in Orlando in 2016, said Robin Merrill in the Los Angeles Times, "it's been getting worse, not better, for the LGBTQ community. In the intervening 6 years, far-right leaders have led American politics down a fearful blame spiral fueled by homophobia, xenophobia, and racism. They have relentlessly promoted the dangerous narrative that queer and transgender people are threats to the health of the nation. This year alone, 25 anti-LGBTQ bills have been enacted in state houses, including 17 anti-transgender laws. And more than 145 anti-transgender bills were introduced across 34 states. Conservatives like Boebert would rather blame such attacks on mental illness," said Brian Broom in the Washington Post. "This shooter was clearly troubled. He had reportedly changed his name as a teen because of online bullying, And last year, he threatened his mother with a homemade bomb. Charges were dropped. But we have to ask why so many supposedly mentally ill people seem to carry right-wing talking points along with their AR-15s. Musk's deepening chaos at Twitter. What happened? Doubts about the survival of Twitter grew this week after Elon Musk instigated a continued exodus of employees and reactivated the accounts of Donald Trump and others banned for violating content standards. Musk last week gave Twitter's 3,700 remaining workers, just half of the company's original workforce before his early November layoffs, an ultimatum. Sign a pledge committing to an extremely hardcore work schedule or accept 3 months' severance pay. About 1,200 employees took the pay and left. And this week, Musk said he planned even more layoffs. Most of Twitter's content moderation staff has exited, and current and former employees report that two or fewer engineers are overseeing some critical functions. Musk last week lifted the site's suspension of Trump after posting a poll asking whether he should be reinstated, saying the people have spoken. Twitter banned Trump after the January 6 attack on the Capitol, saying he had incited violence. But Trump hasn't tweeted since his reinstatement, and he is contractually obliged by his own site, Truth Social, not to post any social media messages elsewhere first. Twitter also reactivated the accounts of Kanye West, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and other public figures banned for spreading hateful messages or misinformation. What the columnist said. Twitter is not going to shut down today or tomorrow, said Parmi Olson in Bloomberg. But Musk's erratic decisions are hollowing it out and chasing away advertisers. After being forced to finalize his $44 billion purchase, he could be desperate to claw back his investment and repay creditors. But his staff cuts and loss of content moderation are almost certain to backfire. The media establishment is not bothering to disguise its ill will toward Musk, said Andrew Stuttiford in National Review, so it's looking for evidence that Musk is failing. Major media journalists exist in a curious symbiosis with Twitter, but they can't stand this interloper who is challenging them as gatekeepers of information by allowing speech that offends them. Nothing Musk has done suggests that the Twitter chaos is primarily about business, said Richard Seymour in The Guardian. Egged on by right-wing libertarian billionaires such as Silicon Valley provocateur Peter Thiel, he appears to be determined to trigger the libs and is inviting it in purveyors of incitement, disinformation, and far-right propaganda. Musk's devoted acolytes insist he knows what he's doing, said Helene Olin in the Washington Post. But even if his bold gambles with Tesla and SpaceX paid off, he is grasping at virtual straws this time. We Americans too often fall prey to the myth of the billionaire genius who is always able to prove the doubters wrong. Till suddenly, he is not. Controversy of the week. Congress. What to expect from a GOP House. Republicans campaigned for the midterm elections on inflation, crime, and other issues that concern all Americans, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Naturally, then, the first order of business for their new House majority will be, checks notes, investigating Hunter Biden. Representative Jim Jordan and James Comer, incoming chairs of the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees, announced last week that in January they will immediately launch a probe into the alleged corruption of President Biden's wayward son, just part of the unhinged theatrics we can expect over the next 2 years. This is the same GOP that spent 4 years studiously ignoring the blatant, systematic corruption of Donald Trump and his family, and that now has not made a peep of protest over the $2 billion investment Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman bestowed on his pal Jared Kushner. Presumptive Speaker Kevin McCarthy will have only a narrow majority in the House and will need the Freedom Caucus / MAGA Brigade's full support in every vote. In return, said Kurt Bardella in The Atlantic, the far-right radicals are demanding endless partisan investigations of every Fox News boogeyman from Hunter Biden to Anthony Fauci to Merrick Garland. Remember the last GOP House and its ludicrous, interminable quest to blame Hillary Clinton for the terrorist attack in Benghazi? The next 2 years will be Benghazi times infinity. It's called oversight, said Rich Lowry in National Review, and it's a common feature of so-called divided government. Given that any bill House Republicans pass will hit a brick wall in the Democratic Senate, why shouldn't they use their time and new subpoena power investigating the fiasco of our withdrawal from Afghanistan or the Center for Disease Control's chaotic response to the pandemic? Hunter Biden is not Benghazi, said Mathathias Schwartz in Business Insider. The president's son really did make millions overseas by trading on the Biden name, activities Biden Sr. clearly knew about and tolerated. In fact, the then vice president took Hunter on a 2013 official visit to Beijing and briefly met with a Chinese venture capitalist doing business with Hunter. There's more than enough evidence that Joe was in the loop to merit a serious investigation. Who expects seriousness from Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene? Asked Nick Cotagio in the Dispatch. The wild-eyed Georgia congresswoman is getting a seat on the Oversight Committee and has already made McCarthy promise to investigate the prison treatment of the goons who tried to overthrow the government on January 6. Green, Representative Matt Gaetz, and other Trump acolytes are also vowing to cut off aid to Ukraine. The House GOP's agenda, in short, will be partisan warfare, not policy. A Republican House might find investigative gold in its investigations, said Blake Hounshell in the New York Times, or at least create the impression among voters that Biden has behaved corruptly. But GOP House control may also turn out to be a political gift to Democrats. Divided government makes it much harder for Republicans to blame all problems on Biden. And if the GOP refuses to raise the debt limit, blocks controls on prescription drug prices, or raises the prospect of reducing Social Security and Medicare spending, it will backfire. It won't be fun for Democrats to be in the minority in the House, but it will have its benefits. And as usual, we have on the same page our good week, bad week segment. Seems it was a good week for Arabic lessons. After experts settled the dispute about the pronunciation of the home nation of the World Cup by noting that neither Qatar nor Qatar actually reflects the glottal sound Arabic speakers use for the first letter. Qatar is closer, though. It was a good week for religious icons. After an anonymous buyer paid $218,750 for an old pair of suede Birkenstock leather sandals worn by Apple founder Steve Jobs in the 1970s. The auction house said the sandals' cork and jute footbed retains the imprint of Steve Jobs' feet, which had been shaped after years of use. And it was a good week for free market competition after discount retailer Sam's Club dropped the cost of its in-store hot dog and drink combo meal to $1.38, undercutting the $1.50 hot dog combo meal offered by arch rival Costco for decades. But it was a bad week for pedants, after Merriam-Webster added 500 new words to its official Scrabble Players Dictionary, including internet slang words such as subtweet, bae, that's B-A-E, and amirite, A-M-I-R-I-T-E. It was a bad week for chilling impacts, with new data showing that 27% of Gen Zers say they are hesitant to have sex at all following the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe in June. "The alarm bell is above all of our beds right now," said sex researcher Dr. Justin Garcia. Finally, it was a bad week for making women laugh, after comedian Pete Davidson, 29, rebounded from his breakup with Kim Kardashian by dating model and internet star Emily Ratajkowski. Previously, the non-hunky Davidson has dated Ariana Grande, Kate Beckinsale, Kaya Gerber, Phoebe Denevor, and other A-list actresses and models. On the briefing page, the shadow over the World Cup. The global soccer tournament is being hosted by Qatar, a theocratic petrostate with a terrible track record on human rights. Why Qatar? FIFA, the governing body of professional soccer, decided in 2010 to award the tiny Middle Eastern nation the right to host the world's most watched sporting event. This week, Qatar, which is smaller than Connecticut in size and population, welcomes 32 national teams and an estimated 1.2 million fans for the month-long tournament. Some fans will stay in neighboring countries and on cruise ships docked in the Persian Gulf. About 5 billion people will be watching worldwide, but the games will be played under a cloud. A massive corruption scandal, deadly working conditions, and Qatar's repression of women and LGBTQ people. Even Sepp Blatter, the former FIFA chief, banned from the organization 5 years after Qatar won hosting rights, recently called the choice of that country a mistake. Why was it a mistake? Bribery clearly played a role. Russia and Qatar were among the 9 countries vying in 2010 for the 2018 and 2022 games. The U.S. Justice Department has found that both countries paid millions in bribes to buy off FIFA executives. A former Qatari bid worker claimed she witnessed her colleagues directly offer 3 FIFA officials $1.5 million cash each in exchange for their votes. Several soccer officials have been convicted of crimes connected to the corruption scandal. Though Qatar still denies paying bribes, it has spent lavishly to make itself a name in global sports as a form of public relations, a practice called sports washing. Since winning the 2022 World Cup, Qatar has sunk more than $220 billion into massive construction campaign. Some of the 7 World Cup stadiums now built are air-conditioned because summer temperatures can reach 120 degrees and threaten athletes' health. To avoid the impact of that heat on fans, FIFA eventually moved the start of the Qatar Games from June to November, but that was of little comfort to the 2 million migrant workers who built the stadiums by spending long, grueling days working in the extreme heat. What were the working conditions? Abysmal. Until August 2020, Qatar's kafala system forbade migrants from leaving their jobs or the country, effectively rendering them indentured servants. Despite that system's formal abolition, some companies still exert near-total control over workers. Poor migrants from Asia and Africa have performed hard labor in sweltering heat for little or no pay, enduring squalid living conditions, infrequent water breaks, and physical assaults. Last year, The Guardian reported that more than 6,500 workers from Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka have died since Qatar won hosting rights. The government disputes that figure, but it categorizes nearly 70% of deaths of South Asian laborers as natural, even though they were mostly young men who all had to pass health screenings to get visas. Doctors in Nepal have noticed high rates of organ damage among returning migrants. Amit Ali Magar was 22 when he left the country to help construct a World Cup stadium in the capital, Doha, in 2018. After working shifts of up to 20 hours and enduring nosebleeds and vomiting spells, he returned home. He suffered extensive kidney damage and must undergo dialysis for the rest of his life. "It was really torture to work there," he said. How does Qatar treat its own citizens? The state's Sharia-based legal code limits women's rights and outlaws homosexuality. Young women need a male guardian's permission to marry, leave the country, or work in certain jobs. Sex outside of marriage is outlawed. Women who file rape charges can find themselves prosecuted and flogged if authorities decide the encounter was consensual. Hospitals have reported unwed mothers to the police. Qatar is one of 11 countries that make homosexuality potentially punishable by death, though gay and lesbian people are more commonly imprisoned or beaten. Are visitors immune from these laws? That isn't entirely clear. Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani said in May that while all people are welcome to the games, we also expect and want people to respect our culture. FIFA claimed in a recent presentation that it was directing Qatari authorities to allow peaceful protest, LGBTQ symbols, and public kissing by fans and athletes. But a Qatari official said no such policy had been approved, so no one knows how Qatar will respond. The UK is sending engagement officers to protect British fans from overzealous police. How have other nations reacted? The U.S. team has incorporated rainbow colors into its badge in a show of LGBTQ solidarity, with goalkeeper Sean Johnson calling the move a sign of our values and what we represent. Australia's players released a video criticizing Qatar for its treatment of gay people and migrant workers. Some cities in France and the UK have canceled broadcast of the games in public places. But in most of the soccer-obsessed world, the World Cup is just too important to boycott or ignore. Magar, the Nepali construction worker on dialysis, grew up idolizing players such as Neymar and Lionel Messi. Despite the lasting damage his time in Qatar did to his health, he still plans to watch. "The great players will be playing there," he said. "So I'll be proud to say that this is the stadium I helped construct." Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with a better way to reduce abortions. The pro-life movement needs to face reality, said Mona Shirin. Legal abortion fans are facing a prolonged backlash at the hand of voters. Anger over the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision fueled many Democratic candidates' victories in the midterm elections And exit polls found that 63% of voters prefer that abortion be legal in all or most circumstances. In six state referenda so far, the pro-choice side won every time, including in conservative Kentucky and Kansas. Near-total bans in 13 states have alarmed voters, as have vague definitions that have left doctors and hospitals afraid to care for women with doomed or dangerous pregnancies. I personally believe that every abortion is a tragedy, but how many abortions will these draconian laws really prevent? Women with means are traveling to other states, and abortions can be induced at home through medication that red states can't control. It's mostly poor women of color who are affected by bans. To reduce abortion prevalence, we should make contraception easily available to everyone and offer lasting financial and moral support to pregnant women who wish there were an alternative to abortion but feel they cannot afford another child. Abortion bans are accomplishing little. Chappelle's hierarchy of oppression. Dave Chappelle believes there can be only one oppressed group in America, said Mark Goldfeder, and it's not gay or trans people or Jews. Though he's one of the funniest people alive, the brilliant Chappelle has a myopia about bigotry that he put on full display in a recent Saturday Night Live monologue about recent anti-Semitic comments by rapper Kanye West and NBA star Kyrie Irving. Chappelle started off criticizing the very hateful things West and Irving said, before pivoting halfway through to blame the targeted minority group for being offended, and to explain how the black community is the real victim. In fact, Chappelle actually reinforced the anti-Semitic ideas West and Irving promoted by suggesting, ha ha ha, that the Jews really do run the world. In his zero-sum understanding of discrimination, Chappelle insists that white Jews and LGBTQ people have no legitimate complaint, while Irving and West deserve a pass, no matter what they say, including promoting Holocaust denial, because race trumps any other form of oppression. He doesn't seem to understand that you can be against homophobia and against anti-Semitism and against racism all at the same time, without in any way cheapening any one of them. This column is from Ukraine, where bombs just keep raining down. Ukraine is getting pummeled, said Igor Duda, and we need more help. As air sirens blared in my hometown of Ternopil last week, I felt the tremors of a powerful explosion. The electricity cut out. A thin trickle of water flowed from the taps, and internet service grew shaky. Russia's massive barrage of missiles, which struck civilian areas and cities across the country, was a reminder that even here in the relative safety of Western Ukraine, our former carefree life is over. As I sat in the total darkness of a city without power, I realized that Putin is terrorizing us because, like a street thug, swearing and swinging his fists, he knows he can get away with it. The West won't hit back at him. We are grateful, of course, that the U.S. and Europe have given us weapons, but they could do much more. A Western-imposed no-fly zone, for example, would stop the bombing overnight. Western experts insist that we should take heart, as Russia is running out of high-precision missiles. But if your house got hit, would you care whether the bomb was primitive or sophisticated? Vladimir Putin proved this week that even if he has to reach into his decaying Soviet arsenal, he's still got enough missiles to bomb the whole of Ukraine back to the Stone Age. And we're on to the last word, our feature article. Title this week, Lost on the Hill of Death. Venezuelan migrants are braving the dangers of the Darien Gap in hopes of settling in the U.S., said Julie Turkowitz in the New York Times. Their desperate journey has now become futile. Darien Gap, Panama. In the darkness, the little girl called out for her mother, her tiny form lit by the moon. The two had left their home in Venezuela a week before, bound for the United States. To get there, though, they would have to cross a brutal jungle called the Darien. But in the chaos of the trek, the child had lost her only parent. To contain her fear, Sarah Quarero, just 6 years old, began to sing. The glory of God, giant and sacred, she croaked through tears. He carries me in his arms. A devastating combination of pandemic fallout, climate change, growing conflict, and rising inflation is creating a seismic shift in global migration, sending millions of people from their homes. In few places is this shift more evident than in the Darien Gap, a hostile, sparsely populated, roadless land bridge connecting South America and Central America that must be traversed to reach the United States on foot. For decades, the Darien was considered so dangerous, only a few thousand dared to cross it each year. Today, it is a traffic jam. Since January, at least 215,000 people have traveled through the Darien, nearly twice as many as last year, and nearly 20 times the yearly average between 2010 and 2020. The enormous flood of migrants through the Darien is feeding a growing political problem in the United States, where more than 2.3 million people have been apprehended at the southern border this year, an unprecedented surge that has put intense pressure on President Joe Biden to stem the flow. The people crossing the Darien this year are overwhelmingly Venezuelan, many of them worn down by years of economic calamity under an authoritarian government. At least 33,000 of the people who've made the journey this year are children. Some migrants come from desperately poor families, but many, like Sarah and her mother, Dari Alexandra Quaro, were once middle class, and now, thrust into desperation by their homeland's financial ruin, have decided to risk their lives in the jungle. Things have gone from bad to worse, said Quaro, 36, who was a lawyer in Venezuela. I decided to take this journey for the future of my daughter. To understand the journey so many are taking, two New York Times journalists crossed the 70-mile Darien route in September and October, interviewing migrants, guides, law enforcement, community leaders, and aid workers. The route began at a Colombian beach town, passed through several farms and indigenous communities, crossed over a grueling mountain called the Hill of Death, and then wound along several rivers before arriving at a government camp in Panama. What became clear is that the Darien has grown into a multi-million-dollar migrant business, increasingly organized to move a maximum number of people, with guides who have assembled into cooperatives, locals who have marked the route with blue flags, and trafficking operations that ply their services openly on Facebook and TikTok. As a result, tens of thousands of people are entering the harrowing jungle, knowing the biggest barrier still lies ahead, finding some way into the United States. The Darien had not been Quaro's first choice or even her second. Raised in Punta Fijo, Venezuela, she had lived in recent years through extreme shortages of food, hyperinflation, and the collapse of nearly every state institution in Venezuela. Earlier this year, she and Sarah had trekked across the Atacama Desert into Chile, thinking they could build a new life there. But Quaro quickly found she could not make ends meet working as a cashier and a taxi driver. Back in Venezuela, she considered applying for a U.S. visa, but discovered that the next available appointment was in 2024. She thought about flying to Mexico and turning herself in at the U.S. border, but learned that Mexico now requires Venezuelans to have a visa to enter the country, the latest in a string of nations along the path to the United States to impose such regulations. She made a decision. She and Sarah would head for the jungle. In Venezuela, they sold everything, even their plastic Christmas tree, and left on a bus with their passports, $820 in cash, and a blessing from Cuaro's mother. On the route, she had promised, "You're going to find angels." The Darien jungle was once among the world's most untouched rainforest. Parts were so inaccessible that when engineers built the Pan American Highway in the 1930s, linking Alaska to Argentina, only one major stretch was left unfinished, a 66-mile piece called the Darien Gap. Today, the most common path through the gap begins in the Colombian beach town of Capurgana, where Sarah and her mother clambered from motorboats advertising responsible tourism onto a dock crowded with other migrants. Men from a newly formed cooperative called Asotocap ushered the group into a walled compound where they explained that the migrants would be assigned guides who would take them the first few days into the jungle for a fee of $50 to $150 a person. Sarah and her mother had joined a group with nine others. Together, they handed over $1,200. The first days took them up a half a dozen hills in a part of the forest inhabited by small communities. In recent months, some had built crude camps to serve the migrants, charging them to pitch a tent or buy food. Those lucky enough to make it to these camps each night slept amid the relative safety of others, washed their clothes in nearby rivers, nursed the day's wounds, and cooked rice and canned sausages over small fires. Those who moved slowly or who got lost on the way spent the night in tents or out in the open, on the ground between the trees. On the second day of their jungle trip, Sarah and her mother passed a cluster of trees hiding a body, decomposing in a tent, dead of unknown causes. On day three, they reached a river, where locals were charging $10 for a 90-second boat crossing. On day four, they camped in a town where locals encircled the migrant camp with wire, charging $20 a person to leave. And on the fourth morning, just before reaching the towering mud-slick mountain known as the Hill of Death, Sarah and her mother lost each other. As desperation has grown around the globe, social media has become a powerful amplifier of the Darien route. In the last year alone, Darien-related hashtags on TikTok have received more than 1 billion views, while Facebook groups with names like Darien New Route to Panama have attracted hundreds of thousands of followers. Sometimes those posting are other migrants explaining what to bring or where to start the trek. Other posts are written by swindlers claiming that the route is not that difficult, or even that the United States is offering sanctuary to certain nationalities. Then they sell their guide services. On TikTok, a company called Venetours makes the trip sound like a vacation. 4 days in the jungle with responsible guides, reads a Venetours post. All of Central America with VIP transport and guides, plus cell phone chip, so you're always in touch. Lodging, food, safe passage, 100% guaranteed. The morning Sarah and her mother were set to climb the Hill of Death, Cuaro had asked a friend she had made on the journey, Angel Garcia, 42, to help carry her daughter. Almost the moment they had left Capurgana, Cuaro's boots had become to grind at her skin, and her feet were now so blistered and filled with pus she could barely walk. Garcia, who had left his own 6-year-old son at home in Colombia, hoisted Sarah on his shoulders, looking back constantly for her mother. Eventually, he turned around, and she was gone. That night, at a camp strewn with dirty diapers, plastic bottles, and discarded clothing, Sarah slept in a tent with Garcia and two of his friends. The men doted on her, lending her a T-shirt, turning away as she changed. But they seemed terrified by their new responsibility. In the morning, they held a meeting. They had no idea where Sarah's mother was or if she was injured or worse. They had very little left to eat and several days more to hike. They needed to get Sarah as quickly as possible to the end of the route, where they believed there were officials who could help her. They packed up their tent. "And my mom?" Sarah asked Garcia. "We'll see her on the route," he told her. On the eighth day of the trek through the jungle, Sarah and Garcia arrived at a camp in a town that marked the next-to-last stop in Darien. Panamanian officials had set up a migration checkpoint in an effort to count the number of people crossing through the forest. They separated Sarah from Garcia, putting her in a back room with other children who had also lost their parents. Sarah had now been separated from her mother for 3 days. Hours went by, and then suddenly, Quaro appeared, rushing into the room. All along, she had been just a few hours behind, trying desperately to keep up. Other families had not been so lucky. Just a few days before, a 10-year-old girl named Helen drowned in a fast-running river as she slipped from her mother's arms. A few days later, a 6-year-old boy named Alexander was also presumed dead after a river carried him away. Quaro's feet were so badly wounded that she struggled to stand. "Forgive me," she cried, kissing Sarah's face, her arms. "I didn't abandon you," she insisted. "I came to find you." Their joy was short-lived. Like many Venezuelans, Quaro left for the Darien believing that if she managed to cross the jungle and make it through Central America and Mexico, the United States would let her in. Because Washington had no relationship with Caracas, it had no way of deporting Venezuelans back home. And in recent months, the United States had allowed thousands of Venezuelans to enter the country and ask for asylum. Word of this had spread rapidly, helping to drive a massive surge to the border. Now the Biden administration was struggling to deal with a widening humanitarian and political crisis. Sarah and her mother exited the Darien on October 10th. 2 days later, the Department of Homeland Security announced that Venezuelans who arrived at the U.S. southern border would no longer be allowed to enter the United States. A small number of Venezuelans, 24,000 people, would be given legal entry if they applied from abroad and if they had a U.S. sponsor. Sponsors had to be U.S. citizens or meet other residency requirements and demonstrate an ability to financially support an immigrant for up to 2 years. Quaro was devastated. She had no sponsor. By this point, she and Sarah had taken a series of buses to Honduras. They had used all their money. Now, in Tegucigalpa, the Honduran capital, she considered her options, weighing in her mind the trauma of trying to get to a country where they would almost surely be rejected. "I write this to you with tears in my eyes," she said in a text message. She was going to a migration office to beg for a flight home. "It pains me to abandon the dream of living in a safe place," she wrote, "but the situation has forced my hand." Quaro and her daughter wound up in a shelter in Honduras with a dozen other Venezuelan migrants. There she waited for her family to gather enough money to buy them flights home. A sister had arrived in Florida a few months before, after turning herself in at the border, and told Quaro that she was racing to find someone who would sponsor them under the new entry program before all the slots were filled. Sarah, struggling with a cold, roamed listlessly around the shelter. Of the journey that had ended there, the mud, the rivers, the terrifying nights without her mother, she said, she remembered everything. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read one of the health and science short pieces. Bivalent COVID booster raises immunity. Moderna's new COVID booster vaccine produces a strong immune response against Omicron variants, the company's data show. The new shot is tailored to the subvariants BA4 and BA5. And in phase 3 clinical trials, people with a prior infection who received it showed more than 5 times as many neutralizing antibodies as those who received only the original vaccine and booster. Among those who had never been infected, the increase in antibodies was 6-fold. This success rate is important because the two newer strains can evade some of the protections offered by the original shots. That really bodes well for the vaccine and public health, Moderna President Stephen Hoge tells the Wall Street Journal. Pfizer's bivalent booster, for its part, generated 4 times more antibodies than the original vaccine in older adults. The two variants are no longer the main ones in the U.S., as BQ1 and BQ11 now account for some 44% of infections. But while the booster may not ward off infection, it should provide protection against serious illness and death. Just 31.4 million Americans have received a booster, about 10% of the eligible population of people ages 5 and older. I hope anybody who was waiting until the phase 3 data was in will now have that peace of mind to go and get a booster, says Hoge. And we'll turn over to the talking points page. We'll start with that article about Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi, a progressive pragmatist who knew how to lead. Nancy Pelosi will be a hard act to follow, said Jackie Calmes in the Los Angeles Times. The House Speaker, 82, announced last week that she will step down from leadership and serve her next term among Democrats rank and file after 8 years as Speaker and 12 as Minority Leader. The GOP has demonized her for years, raising untold millions by stoking hatred of the wealthy San Francisco liberal. Yet only Republicans blinded by partisan hate won't concede how effective Pelosi has been in herding the cats of a diverse and restive Democratic caucus, divided by ideology and geography. She ranks with Sam Rayburn and Henry Clay as one of the greatest speakers in U.S. history, with such legislative highlights as the unpopular but necessary $700 billion bailout of Wall Street in 2008, passage of the Affordable Care Act, and last year's $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. The first woman speaker is famous for her toughness, said Amy Davidson Sorkin in The New Yorker. When the ACA was in dire trouble because many House progressives objected to how the Senate had weakened it, she whipped the necessary 219 Democrats into a yes and succeeded in sending President Obama's signature legislation to his desk. Her guts and toughness were on display again last week when she addressed speculation that a right-wing lunatic's brutal attack on her husband, Paul, had forced her to step back. If anything, it made me think about staying, Pelosi said. I couldn't give them that satisfaction. Good riddance, said Andrew Ferguson in the Washington Free Beacon. Pelosi was indeed a master of Washington politics, going to shameless lengths to have her way while spending trillions in taxpayer dollars. Responding to concerns in 2010 that the ACA draft had grown bloated and overcomplicated, Pelosi infamously responded, "We have to pass the bill so you can find out what's in it." That quip captured the broken system that Pelosi thrived in, marked by endless longueurs that lulled the public to sleep, followed by blind, frenetic fits of legislative activity before the public's attention could be roused. Her record is not especially impressive, considering the massive majority she presided over, said Charles Cook in National Review. House Democrats had a 40-plus seat majority in 2010. After Obamacare passed, angry voters delivered a 63-seat red wave, stripping Pelosi of her speakership. Pelosi's strongest moments were actually during her two terms with Republicans in the White House, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg. In 2007, she resisted Democratic calls for a revenge impeachment of President George W. Bush over the Iraq War, which she believed would divide and damage the nation. When liberals pushed to impeach President Trump, Pelosi waited until the facts absolutely demanded action and then successfully impeached him twice. In 2020, Pelosi marshaled the votes to pass the first package of about $5 billion in COVID relief funds that saved millions of Americans from poverty. Pelosi was a total badass, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. Brutally pragmatic, she worked around the clock to wheedle or pressure legislators for their votes, turning the temperature in her office up or down to uncomfortable levels during negotiations, or withholding serving food until lawmakers came to an agreement. Even Trump was clearly in awe of her and had no idea how to deal with her, treating him like a petulant man-child. The daughter of a former Baltimore mayor, Pelosi also excelled at politics' dirty work, raising $1.3 billion for Democratic campaigns over the past 20 years. She could be a petty partisan, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, like in 2020 when she tore up a copy of Trump's State of the Union address while he was standing in front of her. But Republicans, including the likely next House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, could still learn from her. Pelosi managed to keep the factions of her party, especially the far-left squad of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and company, in line when it mattered. Pelosi did not succeed only because she's a brilliant tactician, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. She made a difference because she had an overarching purpose. Progressives called her too willing to compromise, while conservatives vilified her as some wild-eyed leftist. The truth is that she was both a dedicated progressive and a realist who believed most of all in incremental progress in getting things done. Know your why, Pelosi liked to tell younger women starting political careers. It's good advice for anyone, in or out of politics. Population, is 8 billion people too many? The world's population has reached 8 billion people, said Natalia Kanem in Time, and that's a global success story. We've reached this milestone because of longer life expectancies, fewer maternal and child deaths, and increasingly effective healthcare systems. But many are reacting in apocalyptic terms, declaring that more human beings will only exacerbate climate change. The truth is that population in developed nations has leveled off, with fertility rates dropping below the replacement rate of 2.1 children per woman. Most of the ongoing growth is occurring in developing nations in Africa and Asia, which produce relatively few carbon emissions. Various experts have been conjuring up nightmare scenarios about overpopulation since 1798, said Lauren Leffer in Gizmodo. That's when Thomas Malthus warned in an infamous essay that further growth beyond the 800 million people then on the planet would lead to widespread famine. But our ability to feed ourselves has grown faster than our population has, and every projection of a limit to Earth's human population, or assumed ideal number, has been wrong. Actually, some population alarmism is appropriate, said John Vidal in The Guardian. The global population is now projected to peak at 10.4 billion in the 2080s, which will put more pressure on the resources and produce far more emissions. And yet the population explosion is being ignored, sidestepped, or denied by world leaders. Those leaders need to accept that in an age of climate breakdown, human numbers matter, and the ecological impact of another 2 billion to 3 billion humans will be immense. The education of women and growing availability of contraception are already bending the curve downward, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The end of population expansion is now foreseeable, and over the next 70 years, societal aging will become a major problem. When there are far more old people than young, there aren't enough workers to pay into pension systems, threatening their collapse. This phenomenon is already underway in the U.S., Europe, Japan, and China. For now, we can both acknowledge the downsides of the 8 billionth human and believe this is an occasion worth celebrating. With any luck, the massive challenge of global aging will spur innovation. In that sense, it's a good thing that millions of new people, with their new ideas and fresh energy, are on the way. And a short note or two. More than 500,000 people in healthcare and social services quit their jobs in September alone, largely because of staff shortages, overburdened hospitals and clinics, and burnout from the COVID pandemic. One in five doctors surveyed by the American Medical Association plans on leaving the field within 2 years. The U.S. has seen more than 600 mass shootings so far this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. Not a week has passed this year without at least four mass shootings, defined as a gun crime in which four or more people are injured or killed. And we'll finish with a quote from Mark Twain, who says, "A man who carries a cat by the tail learns something he can learn no other way." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.